This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
We're talking today on Keeping the Faith with two folks who've been doing research and have written a book that's just out on stories of rescue during the Holocaust. Let's see if we have both of our authors on the phone. Bill Timaeus, are you there?
I am.
Good. Good connection. And Rabbi Jacques Kukukorn, are you there?
I'm here.
Wonderful. And now, let's see if I have your names pronounced correctly. The title of the book is easy to remember. They were just people. But Timaeus and Kukukorn as authors, that's a little tougher.
Tougher than Shoemaker, but that's you did well with both.
Correct.
And is it Jacques?
Yes.
Wonderful, Rabbi. Thank you. Well, it's a delight to have both of you on the phone with us from Kansas City. Tell us how this project began. Did you two know each other before you started this work on research on Holocaust victims, or were you? Did you meet each other in the process?
Let me start, Jacques, and then jump in here. We knew each other because, as a journalist with the Kansas City Star, I had known about Jacques and had interviewed him for a series I had done called Conversations with Clergy. And that's how we really got to know each other. And then Jacques went to Poland.
Right. And then during this first trip that I went to Poland, I had the opportunity to meet Irina Sandler, the woman who recently passed away. She was a nominee for the Nobel Peace Prize, who had helped rescue and hide 2,500 Jewish kids, Jewish babies more often, from the Warsaw Ghetto. And I was so inspired by her story. I also was inspired by the idea that there's so many stories that haven't been told, and that so many years after the fact, if we didn't rush to tell them, wouldn't be told, that I thought would be a good idea to write a book. And then, as I like to say jokingly, I was looking for a good writer. I couldn't find one, so I called Bill. The reality is that Bill is a wonderful writer, and he has been a wonderful partner in writing this book, and it's a book that's very interesting because it comes both from the Jewish and the Christian perspective to deal with an issue that relates to Jews and Christians, you know, rescuers and rescuees.
Now, many of the people who rescued Jews during the Holocaust in Poland were Christian, but some were not. Some were, as your book indicates, secular, agnostic, atheist, or...
And there were even accounts of people in places like Serbia, in places that had a Muslim minority, or even a Muslim majority, where Muslims rescued Jews during the Holocaust.
And you even have,
in our book.
And you even have stories of, in one case, a priest who helped rescue one of the Jewish children, and in another case, a Jewish child who was rescued who grew up not knowing he was Jewish and who became a Catholic priest.
Correct.
He was 12 years after his ordination before he really had confirmation that he had been born a Jew. And in the first case you mentioned, Steve, of the priest who helped save two sisters, they were hidden in a convent, at two different convents over time, but their mother did not find them until 2 years after the war had ended. It was 1947 before she finally figured out where they were. Their mother had survived, and finally she turned them up. But by this time, the girls, particularly the older girl that we write about, was so much a part of the Catholic community that she insisted that she would not go with her mother, go back to her mother, unless her mother converted to Catholicism, which she ended up not doing. But that's how much she felt a part of the community that rescued
right.
her.
And interestingly enough, this woman today, who's obviously much older, lives in Ohio, and she's particularly fond of the priest in a university nearby where she lives. I'm sure she still derives great comfort being in this people's company.
Yep.
I want to get into some detail about some of these stories because they are so fascinating. But let me remind listeners that this is a live call-in show here on AM 580. And the numbers to call, if you have a comment or a question or perhaps a story of your own to share, anywhere the program is heard, including on the internet, 1-800-222-9455 is the toll-free number. In Champaign-Urbana, there are several local lines you can access by punching in 333-9455. So if you're listening via computer or via your phone with the live podcast, do use the toll-free number, 1-800-222-WILL. If it's in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Getting back to our guests, so we're talking about their new book out, They Were Just People, just out this fall, Stories of Rescue in Poland During the Holocaust. Rabbi Jacques, why did you go to Poland? You said you...
The first time I got invited to do a wedding, and I had nothing, you know. And, well, Poland was also of great interest to me because all four of my grandparents were Polish, and my family had been in Poland for, I don't know, 700-800 years. So,
and do you speak Polish?
I did not speak Polish the first time I went, but in subsequent trips, I learned enough to get by, or I learned, as Bill would say, I learned enough to get in trouble.
Where did you grow up? Let's learn a little bit about you.
I grew up in São Paulo, Brazil.
Pardon?
I grew up in São Paulo, Brazil.
In São Paulo.
Yeah.
And when did you come to this country?
I came to the States in 1989 to go to rabbinical school.
Where did you go?
At the Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati.
Hebrew Union, uh-huh. And is the synagogue you serve in Kansas City, is that the first one you've been to, the New Reformed Temple?
My third congregation.
Your third. Where were you before this one?
Before I was for 2 years in Washington, D.C., where I was quite friendly with your co-worker who runs All Things Considered. And I was once on that show. And I was then in four years in Sharon, Pennsylvania. And the co-worker is Robert Siegel. Then I was 4 years in Sharon, Pennsylvania. And we have been here 9 years in Kansas City.
Tell us a little bit about the congregation you serve.
My temple is a mid-sized congregation, about 300 families, what's called classical reform. It's the way Reform Judaism was in the 20s and 30s. So the focus is much more on ethics and morals than on rituals. We don't oppose the rituals or don't oppose the ritual garments and stuff like that. We just don't impose them. And we're certainly much more open to understanding that, you know, we try to be ideal Jews in a not ideal world, you know, that... And that people will make choices, and we value above all autonomy. That people will not because religion says you have to do something, you absolutely have to do it, but people will think about it, meditate, figure out if it's meaningful in their lives, and then choose to do it or not.
Now, the rabbi of a temple is the spiritual leader, but you're also considered sort of the resident intellectual, aren't you?
I gather.
So what did your congregation leadership think of you taking on this project?
Well, most people were very supportive. In fact, this was a fairly expensive project, and a good chunk of the money was contributed by members of my temple, of Bill's church, our friends and acquaintances. Most people felt hopeful. I hope they're listening. I hope they feel it's gives us a chance to be on the radio.
Good. Well, I encourage them to call in. I'll give that number again, 1-800-222-9455. And Bill Timaeus, you have been a nationally syndicated columnist from the Kansas City Star. You're the author of a previous book, A Gift of Meaning, and I've previously talked with you on this show about that book, which I appreciated very much. But you're also a lay leader in your congregation. How did your Christian congregation respond to this project of yours?
With a
lot of interest. They were quite intrigued by the work I was doing and would ask me nearly every Sunday when I'd show up, how you doing on the book, and what travels have you and the rabbi done in the last month or so, and so on. So they also contributed to a fund that we set up to defray research expenses, and we were very grateful for that. And in fact, this coming Wednesday night, Jacques and I are doing an event, well, a kind of seminar class at my church, in which we're going to help people walk through some of the questions that readers will find in the reader's guide at the end of the book that challenge them to think about the meaning for their time and place.
I found that very helpful, that section where you talk about some of the big problems, moral issues that face all of us still today on that grew out of your experience and what you learned about people who reached across faith lines to be helpful to people in need at great risk to themselves. But you also sort of go through the book in that guide, and for each of the stories you tell, about 20 stories of people who were rescued, who showed great courage in finding ways to survive, and then the people who helped them, you have specific questions and issues that grow out of each of those. Did you intend this book when you first started it to be useful to small groups, to...
That's an interesting question. I think when we first started it, we were just fascinated by the stories and wanted to tell them because they were so compelling. I think as time went on, we began to see this as Jacques likes to say, and I agree with him, that yes, this is a book about the Holocaust, but it's really not. It's a book about the choices we make today, even, and the moral dilemmas that face us and how we can respond to them. And so once these stories were coming together, I think we sort of looked at each other and said, you know, a study guide at the end would really help to focus the reader's attention on just those questions.
Right. I would say that just like the overall topic of your show, it's about religion, you know, about faith, either the message of what the Bible, for the sake of argument, is relevant to us today. The Bible is not about something that happened 3,000 years ago or whatever number you want to ascribe to it, but rather 2,000 years ago. But how does it impact on my life here today? And in the process of writing this book, we realized that the stories we're telling are not about Jews, are not about Christians, are not about the Holocaust. The Holocaust is just the background against which people had to make decisions, who some were very brave and some were very cowardly. And ultimately, what this book, I think, teaches is makes us think about is what kind of choices we make and what's the impact of our choices in our daily lives. And if I may go on for one more minute, I'll tell you something that happened two nights ago at my temple that I think it has everything to do with what we're talking about.
Yeah.
I'm sure you and your listeners must be acquainted with the Westboro Baptist Church, and they have what they euphemistically call the Crusades of Love, where now they go in front of synagogues and they ticket and protest synagogues. Now they are done protesting.
Fred Phelps is the pastor whose name people would know as an anti-gay protester around
right.
the nation.
And now their new thing, because they're getting nowhere with protesting gays, they're protesting in front of synagogues, and Kansas City is the closest place to them. So we are all the target of, or the object of his crusades of love, so to speak. And they were in front of my synagogue, and I was amazed. That there were seven of them, and then on our side of the street, there were three guys holding plaques, where their plaques said horrible things like, God hates the Jews stole the land, things like that. These guys had signs that said, God is love. God loves, etc. And one of a guy came walking by, and he was a neighbor, and he told me, you know, Rabbi, I live here for 18 years. We live down the street. We think you're great neighbors. I came here to apologize to you and to stand with these people against them. That was one story. And the other story was of a young woman who, I think it's a young woman, sent us an email, the same thing, saying, I'm a neighbor of your synagogue. I'm happy to have you. God bless you. You know, these people don't represent me. Obviously, we live at times that standing up against evil, it's much easier and required much less. But some people don't do it, and these people did it. You know, it's about, ultimately it's about doing what you think is right, not what you think is convenient.
And sometimes it's so difficult to know what is right. For example, some of the people that you talk about in your book, some of the stories, when a Jewish person knocked on their door, they realized that if they took that person in, they were endangering not only their own life, but the lives of their family, their own children. Because at that time, the German soldiers, the Nazis, would kill everyone who was involved where a Jew was being protected.
Right, and often the Jews that we interviewed, we'd ask them, can you explain why the people who saved you did it? And sometimes they just said, it was a miracle. It was just inexplicable. It was, you know, they did something that I probably would not do, they
right.
sometimes said.
Or sometimes they would say, even joking, they must have been crazy, or they must have had like a death wish. Mm. Or one gentleman, Felix Edmund, said, all the time that I was in hiding, I felt guilty that I was endangering the life of seven
sure.
people.
Sure.
You know, conversely, however, when you ask the rescuers why they did it, would be like me asking you, Steve, why do you breathe? How could I do anything else? Hmm. You know, and in fact, what you find among the rescuers is that when you begin telling them, oh, you did such a wonderful thing, they look at you and say, what are you talking about? I did nothing. It's not false modesty. It's true. They believe they did nothing.
We're talking today on Keeping the Faith with the authors of a recent book, They Were Just People, Stories of Rescue in Poland During the Holocaust, Bill Timaeus and Rabbi Jacques Kukierkorn. The last name of the rabbi is spelled Kukierkorn.
And in Polish that, it means?
What's the Polish meaning?
It means sugar and cereal, kind of like carbohydrate.
I don't know what
it probably means that my family must have traded in these goods at some point.
And how did your family end up in Brazil?
Well, we were the lucky ones. My grandfather's family came in totality to Brazil in around the 1929-1930. On my grandmother's side, she was the only one who left Poland. Everybody who was left, parents, brothers, sisters, with the exception of one brother who escaped, everybody was murdered by the Nazis, probably in Treblinka. So we're the lucky ones. We just got out to Latin America before things got really bad.
How much of that history did you know growing up?
Oh, I knew everything. I come from a big rabbinical family, so I have very, very famous ancestors who were famous rabbis in Poland. I even took Bill in Krakow to see the grave of the earliest ancestor of mine that I know where he's buried, that the grave is in existence. Fellow who was the chief rabbi of Krakow, who died in 1633.
That was pretty impressive to see a 1633 date on somebody related to my co-author here.
Bill, what is your religious background?
Mine?
Yes.
I'm an elder in a Presbyterian church. I was raised a Presbyterian and essentially walked away from the church for a number of years, thinking that I didn't want to hang around with a bunch of people I considered hypocrites. And at some point, I discovered, oh, I get it. I'm one of them. So I needed to be back in a congregation to be my spiritual guides. And I've been a member of Second Presbyterian Church in Kansas City for more than 30 years.
When the two of you started this project, did you have any idea how long it would take and where all you'd have to go to get to talk to some of the people who are still living, who had memories to share?
No, I would say no idea. And even now, as we give presentations or we talk with people, people suggest other stories or other accounts. No, part of the writing of the book as well was to try to come up with stories who are more or less different from each other.
Sure.
Because otherwise, the normal pattern of survival by rescue, and by the way, Jews who survived the Holocaust survived in two categories. They were either hidden or they were slave labor. Okay, this is what really boils down to. But among survivors, the common pattern is there's some people have a farmer friend. The farmer takes upon himself to hide them for money or for friendship, and they survive. So how many stories can you tell like this?
Sure.
And we try to look for stories that had different angles. That's part of telling a more, this is not a comprehensive book, it's just accounts, but to try to tell a more complex story. So,
in fact, while we were in Poland, we were searching for the possibility of someone who was saved and then married into the family that saved him or her, and we found that person.
Yes.
We found an example, the Felix Karpman story in the book, and we're pleased to be able to tell it.
Conversely, however, we tried to find somebody who was a Hasidic Jew, like my family were in Poland, who had survived hidden by Gentiles, and we couldn't. And basically because, well, it doesn't mean that they don't exist. We couldn't find it, but I would assume that we couldn't find it because a Hasidic Jew would have a harder time passing for a non-Jew. They also lived such insular lives that made it very difficult for them to have relationships outside of their immediate community, you know, being a more, what I'm going to say, fundamentalist stream of Judaism. So they had no contact outside of their world. So there wouldn't be anybody willing to.
And as you mentioned in your book, that was one of the, probably a moral question for someone who is very observant as a Hasidic Jew who believes that to be faithful, to be observant, well, one must maintain not only certain dietary requirements, but dress requirements and things that put one in public.
Right. See, I think one of the questions we ask in our book is, we should ask ourselves, do I know somebody outside of my immediate realm, you know, white, middle-class Jews, who, if I was in a situation where I needed help, I could go to that person and ask for help? And if I don't, what does that say about me?
Hmm. And Christians could say the same thing, as you point out.
Yeah.
Let me give the phone numbers again for people who might like to join this conversation. 333-9455 is the local number in Champaign-Urbana. Long distance, toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's talk about one of the examples from the book that you just mentioned, someone who ended up marrying someone in the family that was protecting them. Tell us about that.
Felix Karpman was a member of a Jewish family in a town called Gura Kavalia, which was a center of Hasidic Judaism. But he had been friends with a family in town. And at some point, when things really got bad, he turned to actually two different families, non-Jewish families, Catholic families, to give him a place to hide and survive. And in the second one was a young woman who was a sister of two brothers who were friends of Felix. And Mariana, the sister, was part of the family who knew that Felix was hiding and who helped him survive. And they got to know each other more through this experience. And at the end of the war, they kind of looked at each other and said, hey, this is working. Let's make this a long-term deal here. So they've now been married 60-some years when we interviewed them in Poland, and just a wonderful couple. And what's interesting today to me is that Felix is out of this town where there were thousands of Jews at the start of the war. He's one of two Jews left. He keeps the keys to the Jewish cemetery and the synagogue, which is only occasionally used for visiting Hasidic pilgrims, basically. And He's really a secular Jew in many ways. He's not particularly observant. And Mariana is kind of a secular Catholic. She's not active in a church, and yet they get along famously.
Right. Although Felix paid me one of the highest compliments, that this is a man who grew up secular, grew up in a communist country, and the synagogue in Gura Kalvarice is the center for a group of Hasidim called the Gerer Hasidim. Gura in Yiddish is Ger, Yiddish in the language the Jews speak. And there is a connection between my family, I'm a descendant of a Hasidic Rebbe as well, and the Ger dynasty. And actually, Felix even gave me a very special gift from that synagogue. And he paid me the highest compliment by telling me, I don't like those kind of rabbis, but you, Rabbi Zucker Korn, you are a modern rabbi. You're the rabbi I would go to the synagogue.
Let's review a little bit history for listeners who, as I was, not really up to date on the start of the war in Poland. Germany invaded Poland in September 1st of 39. By the 21st of September, there were already instructions that the Jews in Poland were to be gathered into ghettos near railroads and a census taken. Ghettos were established then in other places later that year. By January of 1940, there was a registration of all Jewish property. Ghettos were sealed off by April 30th of 1940. Germany invaded the Soviet Union in 41.
Just so people know, that about 2 weeks after the Germans had invaded from the west and the south, Soviet Union invaded Poland from the east, and in a kind of an alliance, an agreement between Germany and the Soviets, there was a division of who would take over where.
Mm-hmm.
But in June of 41, the Germans decided to drive the Soviets out of the east. And at that point, the Jews in the east, who were essentially protected under Soviet rule, discovered that the Germans were coming in, and they were now targets for sure.
Now, Jews had been ordered to wear special markings on their clothing clear back in 39. And, of course, by the time the United States eventually entered the war after Pearl Harbor, had Jews already started going into hiding?
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Yeah, there certainly were some. And those who could were leaving both Germany and Poland and elsewhere to go to the West, to go to Palestine, to Israel. There was both at one point, at one and the same time, a movement out of the area by Jews and a movement into hiding, and yet also a belief that they would survive this, that they'd been through a lot before, they would get through this. Nobody could really imagine what became known as the Final Solution, where Hitler's regime decided to murder all of the Jews of Europe and succeeded in doing two-thirds of that task.
Now, by 1945, when the war came to an end finally and Auschwitz and the other concentration camps were liberated, some of the Jews who had been in hiding, who had been rescued, had been there for perhaps even longer, 4 years or even longer?
Some cases, yes.
Some of the people in our book,
in some cases,
have been hiding
went into
2 or 3 years.
And then went into hiding. There isn't a single pattern.
Of course. But I was trying to remember from the 20 stories you tell who might have been in hiding the longest. And I know I remember someone who'd been there 4 years, you said, in an underground cave under someone's house for 4 years. It's just unimaginable.
The Maria DeVinci story, she spent 27 or 8 months under the floors of barns, and the girls, the Turkletaub story, Barbara and her sister Leo went into hiding in the, like, I want to say 43 or something, and it was 47 before their mother found them.
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah, now some people were hidden briefly and near the end of the war.
Right. Steve, perhaps a very important point also that I think we try to drive when we give lectures is that survival was a day-to-day operation. Mm. Okay, so sometimes you go stay with the family for a few days, and then you go out and hide in the woods and then come back or go to somebody else's house. And the few who survive, yes, they may have received help from one person for 27 months, but if they hadn't received help for 2 days from somebody else before or 2 days from somebody else after, they wouldn't have survived. To survive, you need to survive every day. So even small actions, small acts of goodness on the part of people who could help them ended up leading to them surviving.
Right, and sometimes we don't know the names of people who did small acts. There were people who would give a Jew help for part of an afternoon, or give him a meal, or something, just to get him through that, him or her through that day. And you know, a lot of those names are lost, but there certainly were some people who did that. At the same time, there were Poles, non-Jewish Poles, who were happy that Germany was coming in and wiping out the Jews. Poland has a deserved and long reputation for anti-Semitism. And today, what's interesting to me is that although at the start of the war there were nearly 3.5 million Jews, by the end of the war more than 90% were murdered. And the next year, a pogrom happened in July of 46 that basically drove the rest of the Jews out of Poland. And today, there might be 20,000 Jews in Poland, 20,000 people who would identify themselves openly as Jews. There are more each day as the Jewish life begins to return to Poland, but it's an amazingly small number compared to what was there 60-some years ago.
Right. But it also happened, I know because of my connections with the Reform Synagogue in Warsaw, that people come in, they may be an old person, say, you know, as a baby I was given to a Christian family and my mother just passed away and she told me I was a Jew. Or somebody comes in and says, oh, my grandfather, my grandmother were Jews who were in hiding. They never professed Judaism afterwards, but I'm interested in coming back.
Hmm.
So there is a sort of a Jewish revival going on in Poland right now.
Most of what you find, though, is some vibrant Jewish life in the sense that there are Jewish restaurants and Jewish festivals and so on, but most of it is done by non-Jews for non-Jews.
Hmm.
Like in the University of Lublin, there's a woman who teaches Yiddish. She's not Jewish. The students are not Jewish. And later they perform Yiddish plays in the Yiddish language to all non-Jewish audiences. Because Lublin, that's where my family lived on my grandmother's side before the war, that had 80,000 Jews, today has 22 Jews. So these people can fill a restaurant or a play.
So part of Poland is accepting of that rich Jewish culture, but for others there's still anti-Semitism.
Yes.
Yeah, there is today something called Radio Maria, which is run by a kind of renegade Catholic priest that the Pope has tried to stand against, and he produces anti-Semitic smut regularly. At the same time, I think the younger Poles are much more open to a diverse society and are willing and desirous of having diversity in the society.
There was so much fear, of course, of the German soldiers among the Polish people and particularly the Polish Jews, but you tell of several people who had experiences with German soldiers where they were pretty sure that German soldier knew they were Jewish, but that German soldier showed some compassion and let them go on with their masquerade.
You know, we have an account of a woman, Irene Baum, who she was being hidden by the head of police of her town. He's a Polish man, a Christian, whose job was to go and hunt Jews hiding in the forest. And he did it. And at the same time, he was hiding Irene and her mom in his house. It's difficult to explain. It's difficult to explain people's motivation.
Yes. And what they felt they had to do to survive and their family to survive, and yet trying to reach out at the same time.
Or if you want to be a bit more cynical.
Yes, you could be.
You could say that people sometimes play both sides. They do what they have to do to survive and to get ahead, because also you need to understand that there was an awful lot of economic incentive in persecuting the Jews. It was good.
And in some cases, they
keep their goods and their money and their gold,
sure,
etc. But on one hand, they do what they have to do. On the other hand, they say, yeah, but I wasn't that bad because I was hiding a Jew myself. That will be a cynical view.
And in other cases, people hid Jews for money.
Yep.
Yes.
And it was clear their motivation was they needed the money and they wanted it. And in some cases, they then later turned them in and kept the money.
That's exactly what I was going to say. Interestingly enough, in Israel, there's a Holocaust museum called the Yad Vashem, and they recognize righteous among the nations, people who did things to help Jews during the Holocaust. And they only recognize as righteous among the nations and give them a diploma and a medal, and that potentially may lead them to get some, if they're needy, to get financial help from an American Jewish organization that we are supporting, if they did it for no financial gain. And Bill and I, whereas we understand that they're entitled to do whatever they want, we think that if you rescue somebody for money or not for money, it doesn't matter. If you're in danger and somebody says, I'll save you, but I want money, no, better you should die and keep your money, you know, it would be stupid. And as you pointed out, even the people who rescued for money, once they have taken enough money out of their Jewish clients, they could turn them in. But in fact, the fact that they chose to uphold their end of the bargain, and many in fact did, hid Jews, took their money, and then turned them over to the Nazis. But many people didn't. So that I also think is meritorious.
Let's talk a little bit about the way you wrote this book that tell these stories of rescue during the Holocaust. You say at the beginning that it's not an academic exercise. It's not part of the study, Holocaust studies, not part of a university supported research. The kind of research you did was to tell human stories that humans alive today can learn something from, can benefit from, but you also wanted to tell them in a way that was moving. And yet it doesn't become, they don't become maudlin. I'm impressed by your restraint.
Right. I think Bill is particularly good at allowing people, making sure that the stories are told in their voice. It's not his voice, not one voice going throughout the book, but rather the voice of each person being interviewed. And in that sense, he did a great job. We did the interviews together, we did the research together. Then Bill would write and we'd sit together and go over time and time and time again. You know, and my secretary at Temple was very helpful in reading. Afterwards, satisfied, she would read and say if it made sense or not. Our wives were enlisted or compulsorily enlisted. There's slave labor involved in doing that to try to get, on one hand, their voice, on the other hand, to complement it with the historical information, the outside relevant information.
I think one of the things we learned, Steve, in going through this process and in consulting with some people who would be considered Holocaust scholars is that the approach that is most acceptable in Holocaust literature these days is a restrained voice. You don't want to... The Holocaust stories themselves are so incredible and so moving and so violent and so stunning that it's not necessary to load up with lots of of overwrought adjectives and adverbs, and you simply tell the story. And I would say that when we began this project, we were more likely to use some of those adjectives. And as we consulted with others and as we moved through this, we found a more neutral tone, so the story itself would shine through and the voice of the people whose stories we're telling could be heard more clearly.
We're about two-thirds through our program today. We're talking about a book, They Were Just People, Stories of Rescue in Poland During the Holocaust, written by the authors that we're interviewing today live here on Keeping the Faith. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the usual host for these programs on Sunday nights here on AM 580.
Steve, can I make a plug?
Of course.
Both for our webpage, it's www.theywerejustpeople.com, the name of the book, theywerejustpeople.com. And we also have a fairly active page on Facebook called They Were Just People.
So anybody who's on Facebook, just do a search on They Were Just People and you'll find us. And we're hosting a kind of conversation there. We're raising there some of the questions week by week that are in the study guide, the reader's guide, and getting a conversation going. So it's a good place to leap in.
And the book is published by University of Missouri Press in both hardback and paper.
Right, and the first edition sold out in 2 weeks.
Ah, very quickly.
Yes. Yeah. So and 100% of our proceeds, our royalties from the writing the book are going to support something called the Jewish Foundation for the Righteous, which is what I alluded to before, which is a charity that supports non-Jews who rescue Jews during the Holocaust and who are impoverished and who live in normally in places like Poland, Romania, you know, in Eastern Europe.
Yeah, all as Jacques says, all the royalties that go to Holocaust-related charities, mostly to JFR. JFR.org is the website of this organization. We've got a short chapter in the back of the book about it, but it's based in New York and a great organization that really financially supports needy
and non-Jews. And when we give lectures, part of our lecturing fee also goes to support those charities.
Let me tell listeners again, if you have a comment or question, do give us a call, 1-800-222-9455, or in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Our technical director, Kyle Crow, will answer the phone and get you on the air with our guests today. Coming up on Keeping the Faith next week, I might just mention I'll be traveling, but Don Nolan will be sitting in this studio for the next 3 weeks. He'll be interviewing on October 11th folks from the Muslim organization here at the University of Illinois, the Intercultural Friendship Foundation. On October 18th, he'll be interviewing Amy Penny, who is a teacher at Parkland College. She'll be talking about the spirituality of teaching. On October 25th, Don's guest will be Jennifer Little, talking about Pauline Christianity. Then I'll be back by November 1st, and we'll be talking with Renee Clausen, an internationally known composer and conductor, choral conductor from Concordia College, and Julie Beiler, the director of the chorale in the Champaign-Urbana area. On November 15, I'll be talking with representatives from Peaceful Tomorrows, an organization set up by family members of victims of the 9/11 tragedies, who are working for peace and who are very much opposed to sort of retribution for those events. So we have some interesting folks coming up here on Keeping the Faith on AM 580, a radio service of the College of Media at Illinois.
Just a little crossover, Steve. Yeah. The Peaceful Tomorrows group is a group that one of my sisters has been active in because her son died on 9/11 as a passenger on the first plane to hit the World Trade Center. So that will be a show that I'm sure she will be interested in hearing.
Well, we're very pleased that members of that group are willing to talk with us on the radio. So that'll be coming up in November. One other just quick announcement for folks locally or within driving distance of Champaign-Urbana. On Saturday, October 17, St. Patrick's Catholic Church is hosting an interfaith gathering called One Light, Many Lamps. And it's an all-day affair going from 10 till 4:30, led by Brother Joseph Kilkovice, who is the founding director of the Shem Center for Interfaith Spirituality in Oak Park, Illinois. And if you'd like more information about that, do give a phone call to St. Patrick's Catholic Church in Urbana. That number is 367-2665. Or go to their website, stpaturbana.org, for information about One Light, Many Lamps. Coming up at the University YMCA, which is one of the sponsoring supporters of Keeping the Faith, again this week, our programs at Tuesday noon, Know Your University, and another free lecture Friday noon for part of the Friday Forum series. Long time, over 80-year series of lectures at the University Y. For information, go to their website, universityymca.org. Well, let's get back to our guest today. Let's hear one of the stories. Do either of you have one that's particularly moves you that you'd like to tell a little bit about?
You choose, Jacques.
Boy, I really like Felix Zandman's story because he is a really remarkable character. You know, as a rabbi, I have had the opportunity to meet many so-called famous people, you know, movie artists. I met the king of Morocco once, you know, that kind of deal. But some of the people we met in this book were really so remarkable, and Felix Zandman is certainly one of them. As a very young man, he was hidden for over a year, almost 2 years, in the basement, in a hole that people dug underneath their bedroom, and he was there in the dark with his uncle, his name was Sander, and they have nothing to do. So his uncle, in the dark, would teach him math, would teach him mathematical concepts, the geometry, trigonometry, etc. And this man, once the war was over, he ends up, long time later, ends up in Paris, where he goes to the Sorbonne, and he's a little, young, poor, Polish, Jewish-Polish refugee, ends up chosen as the student of the century at the Sorbonne, because he, once you have learned to do math and trigonometry in the dark in your mind, you know, college is easy. And apparently he told us the story that the teacher would write a very, very complex equation on the board that would require the students to calculate, you know, for a long time in the paper. And the teacher would finish writing the equation, and he'll shout the answer. The teacher would say, "How do you know?" Yeah, easy, in my mind. He went on to have many, many, many patents. Today we couldn't have a cell phone if it wasn't by some of the patents that he created, like his company is called Vishay. He made lots and lots and lots of money. I mean, he's a multimillionaire of his brain, of his entrepreneurship. And yet a man who always acted very, very ethically, and who the only patent he gave for free is something he created for the Israeli government to make there's a certain Israeli tank called the Merkava that he makes is much more precise. It makes it probably one of the best tanks in the world. It's a patent that he created and he gave as a gift to the Israeli government. He's very well beloved over there.
And the Zandman story also is a wonderful example of how a small act of kindness can save a life. It was Felix's grandmother who at one point took in the woman who saved Felix later. The woman was pregnant. There was trouble at home. She didn't know what to do. She had no money. She goes to Felix's grandmother, and she takes her in, and this baby gets born at the Jewish hospital in Grodno, which at the time was in Poland. Today it's in Belarus. And as a result of that, the woman felt a love and obligation to Felix's grandmother. So when Felix knocked on her door and asked to stay for one night, just to save him for one night, She says, no, God sent you. You will stay here through the war as long as you need to. And she allowed not just Felix, but five or six other people to live in this pit underneath there as a response to a kindness that had been done to her.
And then later, Felix, feeling when he became rich and successful, he employs most of that family. There, you know, there are many children. The children have children. Most of them work for Felix Zenman and his company. So it's the kindness goes back and forth in the family for generations.
You talked about many of the non-Jews who opened their homes, their barns, their fields, their hiding places that they created, had known those people before, and that there was a friendship, there was a relationship, so that was part of why, part of the motives for help.
Right. I think people wouldn't say, I'm saving a Jew. They'd say, I'm saving Joseph, who's my friend. Or I'm saying Peter, who was a classmate of mine.
Or somebody that they had done business with. They had traded horses, or they had bought grain from each other or something like that, and they knew each other in that way. And again, that's, you know, what's the lesson for us? It's to have people outside of our religious, ethnic, economic, social circles to whom we can turn if we need to. If I know only Presbyterians, for heaven's sakes, at some point that's going to get me in trouble. I need to have a much broader circle of friends and acquaintances, and that's one of the lessons that I think we took from this book.
Bill Timaeus, give us another story from your book.
Well, one of the stories that I particularly liked was the one about the man who did not learn until 12 years after he was ordained a priest that he had been born a Jew. His mother, at the time that he was born, early in the war, already had a little boy whom she had tried to give away to a family, and that family had taken the money, or the woman who had taken the money to raise this child, and then a few days later gave the child back and kept the money. But she really wanted to save this little boy, Romuald. So she knew a woman.
Jacob.
She knew a woman and her husband through some business dealings. And she went to the woman and said, look, I know that you, as a Christian, believe in the Jew Jesus. I want you to take my little Jewish baby and raise him as your own, and someday he will be a teacher and will minister to your people. And the woman felt she could not turn down this request without angering Jesus. I mean, she had to do it because she loved Jesus. So she takes this kid and raises him as her own, as the family does. And there are a few little hints when he's a child that he's different. He wonders why when his parents give birth to a daughter later, why he doesn't look like her, and why he doesn't look like his parents, and he decides that on his own, in his own mind, he decides that his mother must have been raped in the war, and that's why, you know, his father was some bad soldier or something. But finally, he comes to a point where he confronts his mother, and eventually she says, look, I just saved you. You had a wonderful Jewish mother, And yet, at that time, he still doesn't know about his own background. He says to his mother, what's my name? And she says, I don't know. I purposely forgot, so I would never give it away under pressure. So at that point, he doesn't know what to do, and a nun comes to him in confession and says something about, you know, her troubles, and he says to her, well, sister, don't worry. If God is with you, you'll be all right. I myself, he said, was saved at 5 minutes to midnight. And immediately she knew, because she had saved Jewish children in the war, she understood that that meant that this priest was Jewish. She asked him about it, and he says, "You're right, but I don't know who my family is." He tells her what he knows about them. He knows what village they were from. He knows that his father was a tailor. He knows he has a brother, had a brother. And she eventually goes to Israel, meets with people from that village, and says, "Okay, here's the deal. Who would this be?" And they all start shouting, "Wexler, Wexler, it's got to be Wexler." So this nun was able to bring back to this man a picture of his Jewish mother. And we have that picture in our book. And just his journey of figuring out who he was after having been saved and the help he got doing that. And today he teaches philosophy at Catholic University in Lublin and is a real bridge between the Jewish and Catholic communities. In fact, he was among those people who met Pope Benedict when he went to Auschwitz a few years ago, and this priest, whose full name is Father Ramiel Jacob Wexler Waskinel, he took his father's name and put it in the middle of his name, showed up wearing both a yarmulke and a Roman collar, and he has a photo of the Pope looking at him with this very surprised look, and he remains today a Catholic priest, but celebrates his Jewish heritage.
And you mentioned in the book that he had written to the former Pope John Paul II after he discovered his Jewish heritage and shared that earlier with him.
Yes, the Pope, when he was a teacher in Krakow, this priest had had him as a teacher, and so he wrote to the Pope and said, "Look, I was born a Jew, what do I do now?" And the Pope writes back and says, "Brother, you're a Catholic priest. We welcome you here. Just know that we love you." And so he has stayed there.
We're out of time, and I've enjoyed this conversation very much. And often we have callers, but today I think sometimes just the subject of the Holocaust strikes people dumb. I've had practice talking about it a bit, but I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you, too. Let me remind listeners, we've been talking with Bill Timaeus, a writer for many years for the Kansas City Star, columnist, nationally syndicated, and with Rabbi Jacques Kukierkorn, who is currently the spiritual leader of the New Reform Temple in Kansas City, Missouri. They're the author of the book, "They Were Just People, Stories of Rescue in Poland During the Holocaust," that has stories and pictures and very helpful maps and a lot of good footnotes if people want to follow things up more closely. Information can be found about the book and their projects at theywerejustpeople.com. And I want to thank them again for being on the program.
And we have a Facebook page. Stephen, and I want to thank you not only for being on the show, but it's become so evident to us that you truly read the book. And I know we truly appreciate you doing it. You did a great job interviewing us.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for being on the show.
Glad to do it.
And for listeners, next week, Don Nolan will be our host. Thank you for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, a production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.